podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha.
Good morning, everybody. I'm very happy to be here. Really happy. I'm very grateful to Amy and to you all for welcoming me. And to be part of this week is so special. I was quite touched by Amy's talk yesterday, so maybe I will repeat things that she said yesterday, but that's fine. I was really touched when we were coming to hear Sandra, to realize that you were all coming from so far, you know, all gathering here. Almost with a heroic quality, like this Portuguese driving across Europe to be here, to see like the Sangha, you know, the Sangha. Amy was speaking of one Sangha, yeah, to see the Sangha gather. And like this act of faith for something that we treasure, that to which we gave our lives, and also to see how much each one of you, each one of us, is making it its own, you know. Really being part of it in a very personal way. Of course, it's a very special week for Roshi and Joa. Something very, for lack of a better word, very mysterious is going on. At the same time, something very clear that really shines from, well, a life spent together. And we can see it in such a beautiful way. When I say a life spent together, I really mean it, you know. It's not just time. It's how much we are able to expose oneself in this connection with the teacher. Expose oneself, let go of oneself, find oneself, and we know it's endless, and still there is, you know, stations, moments that celebrate something, even if we cannot really pinpoint what it is. This is one very special moment of those. And for me, it's very clear that it's not just what's going on for Joa and Amy. It's something that really touches every one of us. I feel for all of us, you know, for myself and for each one of you, I'm very sure of that. This is also a moment, like a coming of age. We spoke about maturity yesterday. It's an invitation for each one of us, even in the way we can take our place and we can fulfill our role, and there's no small roles, big roles. We are all making it happen. And the invitation is there for us to grow. And that's what we are here for. So I brought a koan that Amy mentioned yesterday. It just stayed with me. It's an all-time favorite. It has been commented many times. Even myself, I already, it's not the first time I speak about it, because it's so, for me, so close to what? To our life. So it's a case from a koan collection, the Denkoruku. Some of you know it, maybe all of you know it. It's a text from Keizan Jokin. He is the grandchild, spiritual grandchild of Dogen. So there's Dogen, then Tsugikai, and then Keizan Jokin. And he put together this text, which is called Transmission of the Light, in a beautiful, beautiful way. He collected all these encounters. In our tradition, we honor a transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha through Mahakashapa, Ananda, and so on and so on and so on, to Dogen, well, by lightness, he doesn't put himself as a successor, but Keizan Jokin, and so on, to Maizumi Roshi, Genpo Roshi, Geno Roshi, Amy Roshi, Joa, all of us, you see. It's these encounters, they are very, very, very personal. It's like, it's truly two people who meet in a very sincere way, in a very eager way, eager to open up, eager also to give, to transmit, to help, to support. And that's, again, so obvious in what's going on this week. And so obvious for all of us, not just for Joel. So these cases, they go from one encounter to the other. Roshi spoke of it yesterday. I'm gonna read it again. So it's case number 42, Ryozan Osho. And the way it is formulated, you might find it a little strange, but it's quite clear. You have a teacher and a student, okay? And sometimes in this story, the student has just arrived, or some time went by, and then there's this pivotal moment where something really shifts and they really meet. Anyway, the text addresses the teacher as the patriarch, and the student, he calls him the master, because I feel there's also a quality in this of addressing each person for what she truly is. You know? Of course, there are circumstances and differences, but it touches that the potential that the teacher sees and cares for in each one of us. And, well, I must say there's no bigger blessing than that, to find such a connection and to be able to follow through as honestly as we can. So Ryosan Osho attended upon the second Doan Zenji. So he was his Jisha. And just a little detail, he was passing, he was giving his teacher, he was giving his robe. He was giving him his robes. He was his helper. And already in this, you sense the closeness between these people. They work together. They spend time together. They get close. Sometimes it's so difficult or scary to get close and to expose oneself. Even if it might be a source of misery, sometimes it's easier just to, you know, stay a little bit on the side and show a certain image of oneself. But if you get closer, you get also closer to yourself. Anyway, so as he was handing him the kesa, the robe, the patriarch asked him, "What is that beneath your kesa? What is that beneath the robes?" And of course, you very well understand, it's not about the robes. What we wear, and we sing it in the verse of the kesa, we wear the teaching of the Tathagata. That's what we wear. So, what is that beneath your kesa? The master did not respond. The patriarch said, "It is most painful when one who studies Buddhism has not yet reached that stage. Now you ask me, I'll tell you." The master said, "What is that beneath your kesa?" The patriarch said, "Intimate." The master immediately had great realization. I find it very beautiful and quite telling that, well, you see, there's no blaming in any of this. I think the patriarch is actually speaking from experience. You know? There's no. It is most painful to not yet reach this stage. You know? What is underneath the robe? And now you ask me. I find this movement also very nice because we do make the question our own. It's our own question. Each one of us has this question. What is it about? You know, my life, how shall I live my life? What is important for me? What do I really want? Sometimes we want something, but we don't really know how to address it or how to name it, so we can find these surrogates, we say, like these reasons. But I trust that that is part of the path and take us to what we really, really want. You ask me, I'll tell you. You have to really let the question, which is for those who work on koans, it is very much part of the koan process to embody the question and to trust that within we have the resources to manifest something. And the guy just asks, you know, what else can you do? He just asks, what is that beneath your case? Intimate. What an answer. Huh? What an answer. I think an answer such as this can really open one's heart. Because this quality of intimacy, I mean, does it leave something behind or outside? Is there anything going on here that I should not be intimate with, cannot be intimate with? Yes. You know, if I take the question in the most personal level, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on under here. And, you know, there's confusion, there's pain, there's sorrow, there's regrets. I guess you all have, you know, stuff to add to this list. There's fear, there's confusion. Maybe I already mentioned confusion, but maybe there's a lot of confusion. And yeah, it's funny how, for me, how the koan brings these two lines. You know, the most painful thing, I think that's what brought us here. Maybe we don't express it like that, but this deep intention to realize who we are. And this willingness to do whatever it takes, to travel, to work, to clean toilets, sleep too little, I don't know. For me, reflecting back, I think this like this dissatisfaction, which can really be very painful, this dissatisfaction, in a way, it carried me, you know, kept me going, kept me searching. So, at the same time, there's something else going on also. There's kind of this recognition, this intuition that, yes, that resonates for me. That's what I want. And for some people, concentrates around a teacher, somebody who embodies these qualities that I couldn't even name, you know. I couldn't name it much less think they were mine, that they could be mine, you know, that that could be my path. And suddenly or less suddenly, you find somebody with whom you have a sense that, yes, I want to follow this way. And then, which is very fortunate, you kind of get this sense that, well, this person is not only interested in my case, but she cares for my process, which is really, I mean, it's great. And then, along the way, when we, how to say, when we make a mess, you know, when we behave as human beings, the connection still stands. It's still there, supporting the process, trusting that we too want to go further. See? For me, this relationship has been life-saving. And frankly, especially in the beginning, but it still amazes me, it was mind-blowing to find somebody who seemed to accept me way more than I was able to do. This also has the power to dismantle so much of our protections, our judgments on ourselves and of others, of course, they go together. And what else can come from there than gratitude? Gratitude and this intention to share it, to share it with the Sangha. And to share it with the big Sangha, with everybody, with family, with friends, with neighbors, with everybody. Yeah, also I mentioned the teacher. I could definitely mention the Sangha, you know, to arrive at this place where we feel home. And to find these people, you know, they can be annoying sometimes or weird, but they're nice. We feel, otherwise we wouldn't come back. If we come back, it's because, you know, we like them. I did find myself at home when I met Roshi. Amy was there and Frank was there and other people. So we create also a very special bond between each other, which is so precious also. And to see these connections evolve through time, through thick and thin, as they say, sometimes with conflicts and then with care and space for these things to work themselves out and to meet each other, you know, further down the road. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think I remember. So this recognition thing, for me it's very important because there's not only pain, there's also this joy. You know, there's something very important for me in the story of the Buddha, for those who who like old stars. I know Joa does. I do too, I must confess. I do too. We speak about suffering, old age, and death, and this is what set the young prince Shakyamuni in his quest for the meaning of life. And took him through years and years of hard training, beating himself up, being, I would say, with all due respect, intolerant with his own humanity, you know, eating 2-3 grains of rice a day, practicing all these all these things. And it's very true. I think it's what, at least what brought me to practice, it was suffering and confusion. Not only because, in the beginning there was a big inspiration, a big recognition of this language that was, you know, giving words, and not only giving words to what I felt and what I had always longed for, but also opening a path that I felt I could walk. I started by reading texts. I didn't know anybody at the time in Portugal who was sitting. It was the beginning of the internet. It took me a year to find the Buddhist Union and the sitting group and the Sangha, you know, a community. So I started reading, and there was like the Eightfold Noble Path, and at the very end there was this right meditation thing. I could understand more or less the rest, you know, intellectually, but this meditation was very, very mysterious, what it is about. And you cannot know what it is about by reading in the book. You have to really put yourself into it, which I did. And also there comes like this recognition of, yes, I want to do this. What was I saying? Old age, sickness and death, something along those lines. Yeah, the old texts. Anyway, there is a pivotal moment, a very important moment in the path of this man that took him to this moment of awakening that is expressed in this sentence that Roshi read yesterday. He has a So he has been practicing in a very arduous, demanding way. He is exhausted to the point almost of in a mortifère, in a deadly way. And he has this recollection, this memory of a moment where he was next to his father was plowing a field, apparently, and this young boy was sitting under a tree, and he had this experience of sukha. We speak of dukkha, which is, you know, can be translated in many ways, but maybe one way to say it is suffering or dissatisfaction or something that doesn't turn right, you know, this is not working for me. We have this experience, and it can be very, very strong. But he remembered this moment of sukha, you know, of bliss, of nothing is lacking. And this is actually what the trigger that takes him to the last stage, I would say, of the story that we all know. And then he has this moment of accepting food, accepting to take care of himself, accepting who he is, and then the rest is story. So there's not only the painful side. You also can find so much in here under the robe. Joy, laughter, love, tenderness, hope, compassion, wisdom. Yeah. Also, when you see somebody on the path of becoming who he is, it opens a path for you also. It opens a path for me. Because maybe there's something really deep within oneself that knows that it's possible, know that it exists, this place of appreciation, of fulfillment of what we are. So whatever you do that supports that process, that longing for you, for each one of you, put it in the most selfish way you want. Whatever you find that is taking you there is also opening a path for others and inviting others to trust that they also can do it. We do that to each other, and it's very beautiful in ways that we don't even imagine. We don't know what we can say it's priceless, but we don't know the impact of what we're doing. Many people who have come before have given us their support and their practice, and they offered us their journey. And I'm sure many people who we don't know, who are yet to come, will receive what we are doing. This is also part of what's going on this week, to celebrate the journey, and again, as Amy said yesterday, the maturity of a group, the maturity of a teaching. It's also I'm showing very clearly the preservation, the care for this vehicle, this container that carries us and keeps going. There's no better way of preserving it than to be oneself. You know? Again, it's not about becoming somebody else or of embodying an ideal that is so disconnected from my reality that I will never get there. And seriously, I doubt anybody can, you know? Because if I can't, and what for? Even if one apparently fulfills my fantasies about what a human being should look like, what good is that? You know? We have to do it with what we are and what we feel, what we go through. Even if at times I might think I can't, and I know also these moments from before, like feeling small, limited, or even unwilling to go further. I don't want to go further, I don't want to expose more. Luckily for us, we do want to expose more, we do want to go further. And we do. We do. And we're not alone, you know. We have a lot of help, a lot of help. We don't even realize how much help we have. All these texts, all these rituals, all these practices. And in the context of practice, but in the most broad way. I think of Ian, he today is a cook. 2 weeks ago he was a mason. Mason? That's the word, huh? Mason? Building a wall in Monterey. You know, everything that we kind of practice in life somehow comes together. The connections, the friendships, as Amy was saying yesterday, you know, something we heard like 20 years ago and stayed with me. So stayed with this man, I know. Just an example, but all this. Not to mention, because then we would not have lunch. Not to mention the family. Family is a big one. This also is a family. So much of our family patterns play out in our practice. It's nice to be intimate with that. That's the invitation of the Koan. Be intimate with whatever. It's not about judging or, you know, cherry picking or just in this space of the heart, you know, things can manifest, they can be seen, they can be healed, they can be let go of. Some old ingrained patterns, sometimes they show themselves over and over and over and over and over and over. But hopefully something ends up changing there. So, yeah, I'm really, really happy and touched to be here this week. I learned to see and to appreciate and to love Joa's heart. Kind of it's growing on me, this good heart. To see also that for lack of a better word, the Dharma is spreading. So please, if you want to say something, just say.
I have to leave.
Good. Thank you, too.
Dissatisfaction almost as a way, an alternative way of putting it. Of course, there's a lot of danger in trusting too much in dissatisfaction. But it seems that you are talking about there's in us the right sense that goes through the dissatisfaction, the habitual or the ordinary dissatisfaction. That it's not this, like in the story of the Buddha. And the words
right,
I resonate about it.
I resonate. Yeah. Even, you know, moments of confusion and mistakes, they can be the expression of our heart not feeling at the right place,
mm-hmm.
unsettled, and sometimes our recklessness is an expression of our vital need for freedom, which is in the nature of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we feel locked in a too narrow situation and we want to break free. And sometimes we get something that we want and it's great and then it fades and then the longing is still there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was that, but but no, it was not. Like in the six patriarch story, you know, this encounter with Monk Myo. So the six patriarch received the Roven Bowl from the fifth patriarch. The Sangha was not as mature as this one. So they just wanted to kill the guy because it was not supposed to be him. It was not consensual. So they all started running after him. And there's this guy, Monk Myo, who used to be a police officer of some sorts. I love the way the sutra speaks of him. His ways were rough and his temper was hot. You see? And he used to be a police officer, so he really knew how to chase somebody. You see, like this ignorance that is kind of a wisdom,
mm-hmm.
that can be put to work. And he chased him like no other one did, and he finally gets him. And I'm sure the sixth patriarch can feel the rage that comes after him. So he just places the roving ball on a stone, on the floor. And he says, if you want it, take it. Huh? What about that? And it's true for all of you. You want it, take it. just take it. So the guy, yeah, he wants it, he takes it, but he can't lift it. And then he understands, well, there's this magical, beautiful, magical Chinese way of telling stories, but it expresses something very, very deep. You know? The patriarch says, the sixth patriarch says, this robe is the expression of faith. How can it be taken by force? How can it be taken by force? I thought I could take it by force. You know? If I was strong enough, I would take it. But that's not how it works. Sometimes we take it by weakness, you know, just by being vulnerable and to accepting that we are vulnerable and that we are powerless and that we are, you know, just what we are. And he says he has this movement in the heart where he says, the sixth patriarch asks him, did you come for the robe and ball or did you come for the Dharma? And the guy has this realization, I came for the Dharma. That's what I came for. For me, it was a big moment a few years ago. I think before my purple rakus offering, it was a big realization to see that actually what I want to serve. I want to serve the Dharma. I want to serve Roshi, the Sangha. And actually, I can do it in any position, any situation, any moment of my life. I can be at the service of this, we call it heart, we call it mind, whatever words you find to express it. Why did I tell this? I don't know. Yeah, because
the meaning of winning and
sure, and you see this man, he put himself into it with everything he had, you know, with his anger, with his ignorance, with his greed. He's a very greedy fellow. At some point in the exchange, he has this big awakening. And a moment after, he said, is there something more that the fifth patriarch transmitted to you? You know, he wants more, other than his secret. It's very funny. Other than this secret teaching. Because, well, now I have to say the whole thing, and it's very beautiful. I don't mind. I just hope I have time. So he realizes that there's something that goes beyond what he can grasp, you know, in this story. And this kind of puts him in a situation, in a place of openness. You know, he's open to something that is beyond, is beyond himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And from this openness, he is ready to receive the teaching. If there's no openness, the teacher can't do anything. And that's something that you, as a student, maybe don't realize how powerless the teacher is if the student is not willing to follow, to open up, to expose, to, you see, we express it in many beautiful ways, like bowing, serving, you know, following. But this is not a powerless position. This is very, very brave and very kind thing that we do to oneself, you know, to accept that we follow we let go of our ideas, opinions, should be like this. No, I'm this kind of person, I'm not that kind of person. The teacher, yeah, but you know, it's just a human being actually, now that I start looking a little closer, and it's not this ideal Buddha I was looking for. The courage to go through that and to follow, not to become like a satellite, but to get it back, to get it back in a new way, you see, to get it back. And we get it back, you know, at least in this lineage, I don't know. But anyway, so he asks the sixth patriarch to teach him, and the sixth patriarch says, before thinking good, before thinking not good, what is the true face of Monk Mio? And, well, the question works for him. And then he wants more, but we also know this process of finding something and wanting more, finding more, and if somebody wants to say more.
Say finding more, wanting more.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, you see, sometimes we think we found something, that we have something, that we know something. And it's good. It's really indispensable for this journey, for this process of maybe owning one's life, you know, becoming the host of our own life. And yeah, they're really important, and we build something with this moment. Again, in koan practice is very clear. You work with the koan, you go through, you know, not seeing it, feeling short of understanding it, or of, you know, grasping it, or whatever we want to call it. And then we might come to a place of, you know, clarity with the joy of having found, like, I don't know, a free functioning, or a freedom, or an opening of the heart with this koan. And sometimes it's so strong that we might think, you know, a little bit arrogantly that, well, what is more to understand? And then to have this also this courage, this willingness to see more. And even to see more, I mean, just by the fact that we are alive, things are coming up, you know, constantly. New people, new situations. Each moment is new. So, of course, the life is always bubbling, and it's pointless to try to fix it, because it's just another illusion of ours. Anyway,
but do you think that there's a sort of insight that leads you to understand what is your ego drive and what is...
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
The Buddha drive for.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think it's fortunately part of what we are developing in the West, especially, you know, in this lineage with Amy, Catherine, and all these people. They again, it's a Western practice. It's not like an exotic, imported, faraway belief system. And there is, of course, and I think more and more, maybe, a deep, broad psychological dimension, you know, where we become aware of tendencies and how the mind works, how the ego works, which is different from what I think what might be the reality of Asian people. We have our own background. And we do work on our patterns. For me, for example, was so surprising, really, to see the central place of my family story in my practice, but also in the way I lived my life, you know, even at moments where I thought I was breaking free from those people, you know, and then they get you. They're there. Suddenly you are like 50 years old and you see yourself like your mother. She's still there. You're still eating like your mother. It's like, yeah. And there's also something really tender in that, you know. But in the sense that we express this love and this acceptation for who we are, and this also like heals back, you know. It's very nice because it goes downstream for those we meet. Sometimes we cannot repair what is. There's things we didn't say or we didn't do or we didn't feel or, you know, we didn't have, and that's that. It's like that. But fortunately, we can like send it downstream to the people we meet. But in a mysterious way, also, it heals backwards. Anyway. Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question. There was a clock that I could see at some point.
Oh,
perfect.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.